of Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. COVID vaccinations in McLean County dropped 33% over the last week. County Health Department spokesperson Marianne Menko says the department is trying to use any form of communication possible, including word of mouth, to get people to sign up for a vaccination to get the area closer to herd immunity.
We call them the wait and seers. There are a lot of people out there who are waiting to see. And our question now is, what are you waiting to see? We've been doing vaccines for 5 months. We have literally millions of people who have had vaccines at this point.
Menko says the department has also encountered people who got the first dose and canceled their second dose because of concerns about a potential bad reaction. About 31% of McLean County residents are fully vaccinated. A blistering new watchdog report harshly criticizes management at the state-run LaSalle Veterans Home over its tragic mismanagement of the pandemic. 36 residents of the Veterans Home died in a COVID-19 outbreak. IPR's Tony Arnold reports.
The new Inspector General report found the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs failed to create a COVID-19 plan, failed to educate staff about the virus, and failed to accept outside assistance. One LaSalle nurse told the Inspector General, quote, "Nobody seemed to know what to do." The former leader of the state VA, Linda Chapa-Lavia, already resigned and declined to talk to the Inspector General. Governor J.B. Pritzker's new Veterans Affairs Director tells WBEZ he's committed to recruiting a new leadership team. I'm Tony Arnold.
An obstetrician in Normal says new guidance about the safety of COVID vaccines is reducing hesitancy among pregnant women. Dr. Nona Folk chairs the OBGYN department at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. Folk says she recommends the vaccine, especially given the risks linked to COVID.
Pregnant women can get COVID, and when those women get COVID, the effects from it can be more severe than it is for anyone who is not pregnant, because pregnant women have a compromised immune system. So they're more likely to end up in the hospital, in the ICU, and on a respirator. And the risk of death is higher for those women, too.
Folk says data has shown few, if any, adverse reactions from pregnant women who got the COVID vaccine. But she says it will take longer-term testing before health officials fully endorse the vaccine's use. Bloomington's newly elected mayor and city council members will be sworn in tomorrow. The city has moved the ceremony to the front lawn of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts because of the pandemic. Three-term city council member Mboka Milamwe will officially become the city's first black mayor. Milamwe will replace Terry Renner, who served 8 years in the mayor's office. The city will also swear in three new council members, Nick Becker, Tom Crumpler, and Sheila Motney. New incumbents will also take the oath of office after they won four-year terms. That's Jamie Matthey and Molly Ward. Democratic Congresswoman Sherry Bustos says she's done after 5 terms serving the nation's capital. Bustos announced today in a video announcement she won't seek re-election after her current term ends.
As for the next chapter, well, it will always be my goal to think big and deliver results. And in time, I'll share more on where that will take me.
Bustos narrowly defeated Republican Esther Joy King in the 2020 race for the 17th Congressional District. That includes parts of Peoria. Shortly after the announcement, King announced she will run again in 2022. 2 years after Illinois legalized sports betting, those seeking to grow the lucrative industry's footprint want to make it legal to bet on in-state college athletics. But Illinois universities with Division I athletics programs are still opposed. IPR's Hannah Meisel has more.
Fresh on the heels of the University of Illinois and Loyola University Chicago's March Madness basketball runs, some state lawmakers want to remove the prohibition on Illinois residents betting on in-state college sports. But U of I Athletic Director Josh Whitman says that would open college players up to potential harm and harassment by disgruntled bettors. He cited the social media abuse many student athletes already face from fans.
The commentary is vile, it's abusive, it's threatening. And in some cases, it directly references gambling losses.
Lawmakers have floated a compromise that would allow colleges to suspend betting on their teams for 6 months if harassment becomes a problem. But Whitman said he spoke for all D1 colleges in Illinois when he said that wouldn't be enough protection for players, and they remain opposed. I'm Hannah Meisel.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
It sounds funny, but I feel more independent because I can actually hear people and I have more confidence in that. It's such an empowering feeling.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. In the U.S., the rate of pregnancy-related deaths is continuing to rise. Many maternal health experts say one key to curbing that is making sure new mothers don't lose their health insurance. IPR's Christine Herman looks at Illinois' efforts to ensure new moms keep their coverage after giving birth.
This story is about women dying from childbirth. In the U.S., 700 women die each year from pregnancy-related causes. In fact, this country is the only industrialized nation where the maternal death rate is rising. And here, Black and Indigenous women are at 2 to 3 times greater risk than white women. U.S. Representative Robin Kelly of Illinois says these racial disparities are unacceptable.
When you look at educated Black women with money, they still die more than less educated, less wealthy white women.
She's been spearheading policies to try to address the issue, including a change to Illinois' Medicaid program that aims to ensure new moms don't lose their health coverage soon after their baby is born. In the U.S., many moms enrolled in Medicaid during pregnancy lose that coverage 60 days after giving birth if they surpass income eligibility limits in their state. This happens to hundreds of thousands of women each year. This month, Illinois became the first state to get federal approval to extend Medicaid for a full year after pregnancy for moms with incomes up to about double the federal poverty level.
This is tremendous, extending Medicaid.
Karen Tabdina is a maternal health researcher at the University of Illinois. Of the 70 pregnancy-related deaths in Illinois each year, the data shows most are preventable. Tabdina grew especially concerned when she saw that a growing number of mothers lacking health insurance were turning up in emergency rooms.
Well, the emergency department is not the best place to set up a treatment plan and to ensure that person is followed up with. So by losing people through the cracks, we are losing real lives.
Several other states, including New Jersey, Georgia, and Virginia, are taking similar steps to extend Medicaid coverage. And President Biden's COVID relief package contains a provision to help more states do so. Rachel Burvell is an obstetrician in Seattle and co-founder of the Black OBGYN Project that's working to raise awareness about racial injustices in maternal health care.
Many of the health issues and health problems extend beyond the 60-day period that Medicaid is currently covering.
Medicaid is the largest payer of maternity care in the country, and Black women are overrepresented in the Medicaid population, so they're also overrepresented among those who get kicked off their plan. But there are also structural barriers to getting care, things like transportation issues and inadequate housing. Tabdina says we have to do a better job listening to the tens of thousands of mothers each year who experience dangerous, even life-threatening complications.
We need to understand the real lived stories of our near misses, people that almost die.
And then ask the question, what else needs to change so that no child has to grow up without a mother whose death could have been prevented? I'm Christine Herman.
Sound Ideas, I'm Ryan Denham. Bradley University was facing significant financial challenges due to declining enrollments even before the pandemic began. But by taking a cue from corporate America, the university actually slashed its deficit in half last year, and a surplus is expected by 2023. So what is happening? Tim Shelley speaks with Cheryl Cox, Bradley's new chief financial officer.
Under this budget approach and incentive-based budgeting, we truly feel that this is going to be transformative for the entire university. What this budget approach brings is really we're taking the academic colleges, and when I say the academic colleges, I'm talking business, engineering, and language arts and sciences, and we refer to them as revenue centers with a large portion of the revenue and support costs assigned to them. This approach is designed to really empower the academic organizations with the benefit of responsibility, greater financial stewardship. They'll have the accountability for what we say contributing to the profitability or the positive impact of the university. And, you know, it creates transparency for the entire university.
How much did enrollment decline, and how did Bradley cut the deficit right now? I mean, how did that all happen?
Our enrollment over, I would say, the last couple years has really remained relatively flat. We hope to change that moving forward in the future. We really hope to increase our enrollment dramatically. The second part of the question I do want to address is that, you know, Bradley truly was prepared for a major deficit going into the pandemic, but it seems that that really did not come to fruition. And let me explain that fact, okay? Essentially, the $40 million deficit was essentially a projection as if COVID ceased all operations. Fortunately, at Bradley, we were able to quickly pivot to a hybrid learning experience that included online education. And in addition, there were budget reduction efforts that took place to decrease our deficit to less than $10 million. And by the end of 2020, our losses were cut in half through even further detailed financial planning and cost containment. So, you know, one of the plans that we had for cost containment was we offered a voluntary severance incentive program. And that's just an example of some of the cost containment strategy that we used.
What else can you do to continue addressing deficit? I mean, it's obviously less than projected, but there's still a deficit. I know before President Standiford came on board, there was this whole talk about kind of like a strategic restructuring of the university. So what's in the works maybe?
That's a great question. There are a couple strategic initiatives that we have in place. One of them is called the administration organization transformation process. That's one I lead. And that's really creating efficiencies and increasing effectiveness throughout the organization. Prior to the realignment, many departments were fragmented. They were diffused, meaning that functions were duplicated across the various roles in the university, and core unit functions were widely distributed across the campus. It's important to note that during this initiative, we did not cut any positions, and it was not intentional to cut positions. It was really to reorganize the administrative staff so that we are more effective and better utilizing and repurposing our talent.
That was Bradley University's CFO, Cheryl Cox, speaking with Tim Shell. This is Sound Ideas. District 87 is using its free summer programming to help kids reset ahead of a return to in-person learning this fall. In this Encore interview, Dana Vollmer talks with Assistant Superintendent of Curriculum Diane Wolf about how a year of pandemic learning reshaped their approach.
We wanted to really look at doing summer programming that was energizing and exciting and getting kids back into the social routines of going to school. So we are offering an elementary program that is a full-day program. It operates the same hours as a regular school day, 9 to 3. It offers the school bus for transportation, breakfast, and lunch, and has a combination of both academics and enrichment and exploring. At our junior high level, we are continuing our partnership with the Boys and Girls Club that really looks at what does that middle school level need for their summer. And this year, we're offering that opportunity for incoming sixth graders, which we've never done before. And then we are looking at our high school to really look at students that are coming in to ninth grade that would like to have some additional experiences, all the way up to the students that will be seniors, to say, what do I need to be successful for the upcoming school year?
Why is it important to reintroduce those social patterns before students return in the fall?
Well, I think one of the areas that all of us have learned about is the value of human connection. So I think it's important that the stamina, you know, working from being a remote student at home or even an employee at home, it's a different type of social interaction when you have to get dressed to go out in public and go and work through the social norms of going into a school building and being around other people that are not your family members or your very close friends, and learning some of those social skills that go along with engaging as a citizen in the world, tolerance for other people's opinions, knowing how to advocate for yourself when you're feeling lost. And all of those things are really difficult to do on Zoom.
Define the scope of the learning loss from the pandemic. Are there areas of particular concern?
So I don't know that answer, but I do know this, that I am absolutely adamant that we do not talk about a learning loss. And the reason why I feel so strongly about that is if we think about putting that into the head of a child, what does that say to them? That they've learned nothing? These students that we have right now have lived through a global pandemic. They have learned technology skills and interaction skills that we would have never expected from them before. They have learned how to be self-reliant. They have learned how to digest information in different formats. So, yes, we may have some, quote, learning loss from old school stuff before the pandemic. But we in District 87 are focusing on the learning gains that our students have had and how we can exponentially continue to grow those.
As you said, students are going to need to kind of reset after this last year of learning remotely, some or all of the time. Can that reset be accomplished over the summer, or is that something that's going to trickle into the next school year?
I think it really will depend on if a student has been on remote learning this entire time. And if a student has been in remote learning, which we do have quite a few of our students, then we're going to reset at the beginning of the school year with new rules and responsibilities after we've all lived through a pandemic. Our schools will never, ever look the exact same way they did on March 14th of 2020. We have learned an immense amount about learning. We have learned immense about student resiliency. And so when students come back in the fall, things are going to be different, even if they've been in school in person right now, because as educators and as lifelong learners, we have to take what we have learned over this last, what will become 18 months in August, and say, you know what, these are the things that we have found have really worked. And these are the things that we used to do that we're going to let go because they're not going to work after a pandemic anymore.
And so for families who can't or don't send their children to summer programming, what else can they do to help prepare students for the fall?
The number one thing I would ask all of my parents and all of our community is to not say to the child that they are behind because of the pandemic. When somebody is told that they have lost something or they cannot do something, that does not go away easily. So I would really ask that the first thing is that we change the conversation to say, what have you learned and what can you work on this summer to even make you stronger? Reading every day, reading for fun, reading for information, reading on screens is fine. That will really help a student. And the second thing is, for my elementary students, the basic math facts are very important for them to practice on a daily basis. For fun, you know, a kindergartner, count how many chairs are in the room. It's those questionings, and it's also showing students that the things we're teaching them in school are the foundation, but not the end to learning.
That's District 87 Assistant Superintendent of Curriculum Diane Wolf speaking with Dana Vollmer. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Many visual artists struggled to make and sell their work during the pandemic. Some found inspiration and an audience at Hanger Art Company. Arts correspondent Brianna Groh talks with the owners of the new downtown Bloomington gallery.
At first blush, a pandemic doesn't sound like a great time to open a gallery. But if there is such a thing as a silver lining when it comes to COVID-19, the owners of Hanger Art Company seem to have found one. As the name suggests, Hanger is big, 4,500 square feet to be exact. Santino Lemancusa had something much smaller in mind when he was looking for a shop to sell his photography. And then he came across the former Haphazard Press suite on East Jefferson Street. Looking at those big blank walls got Lamancusa thinking about a piece of art he'd recently bought online from local painter Jeff Bess.
It was a large piece. It was 3 feet by 4 feet. And the painting was called Life is a Highway, and it featured a roadkill possum that was smiling, floating out of the sky. It was just a surreal piece.
Bess told Lamancusa the piece had been sitting around his studio for some time. Just where in town would one exhibit a giant roadkill possum? That gave Lamancusa a big idea.
We could feature large original works from real, you know, local artists that people around town might not have seen before.
Bess is now one of 11 artists currently showing at Hanger Art Company. Just steps away from Bess's darkly surreal scenes, rainbow figures dance across the works of Chicago-based painter Peter Thaddeus. In a normal year, Thaddeus would be working the Chicago Art Festival circuit. But in 2020, Thaddeus was mostly showing his work online.
Which is awful.
His exhibition at Hanger includes 3 pieces from his Pride series.
It's all about life, love, and pride, and all the vibrancy of the LGBTQ community.
Lamancusa says he's most excited to show Vogue, a piece that pays homage to the queer people of color of the 1980s Harlem ballroom scene. Figures bathed in color pose and dance with a fluidity that's come to define Thaddeus's whimsical style.
Peter's work is just something I thought of immediately as not being represented anywhere around here.
Gallery co-owner Ayana Zachary says different seems to be what visitors are craving.
I have seen everyone of all ages, genders. Everyone stops and looks and smiles. And it's bright, it's interactive, it's loving, it's positive, and it opens a dialogue into some things and ideas that we're not always talking about.
Zachary says getting people talking is a major aim at Hanger.
When I moved here, there wasn't a place like this, a big space, not just for art to be, but for people to be, a gathering place, somewhere where people could share ideas or come to work, get inspiration.
Zachary and Lamancusa say they wanted the space itself to encourage visitors to come in and stay a while. So they included seating, kept the bar, and added a pool table and a jukebox. The space also includes a stage that Zachary says they plan to use for live performances.
What we've seen as people come in is we're attracting not just visual artists, but artists of every kind. And so as we meet with more writers, musicians, performers, we are getting closer and closer to having those types of presences here also.
Both Zachary and Lamancusa say the positive feedback from the arts community is gratifying, but it's even more encouraging to watch their featured artists enjoy the exposure. Pat Boyer exhibits his sculptures under the name Fort Coyote. Boyer fashions his figurines from reclaimed wood and scrap parts from computers, tools, and farm equipment that, despite their robotic appearance, are full of personality. Zachary remembers the first time Boyer sold a piece at Hanger.
Seeing Pat's face when the first time somebody bought something or wanted to talk to him about his work because he hadn't had that opportunity before. I mean, it was one of those once-in-a-lifetime things for him, and we were honored to get to be a part of that.
From first-time exhibitors to diverse subject matter to tucked-away works from longtime artists, visitors at Hanger are likely to encounter something they've never seen before, something that makes Lamancusa and Zachary extremely proud. I'm Brianna Groh.
You can follow Hanger Art Company on Facebook for upcoming events and artist features. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal today, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Ryan Denham. We had story help today from IPR's Christine Herman, Dana Vollmer, and Brianna Groh. You can find all these Sound Ideas interviews and stories at WGLT.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast, also available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of the show, so comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 FM, WGLT, WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.